Hi, it's Precious Pioneer, and thank you everyone for tuning in to the Precious Pioneer audio experience. I hope that this episode gives you a new perspective and will inspire you to go out and be great. All the best. Let's chat.
Hi, Precious. I'm David Newman. Pleased to meet you. I'm speaking from London in England. I've been working for the last 30 years on policy issues around environment and public health. And I've been doing this in many ways, both as policy within government and lobbying governments, and also within associations. And you know, you'll have heard of Greenpeace. I worked for them for many years. But also I've been working for government and with government for many years too.
That's amazing. How is it in London right now with everything related to like the quarantine? And are people going outside a little bit more, or is everybody still quarantined and huddled at home?
Well, we just had from this morning a new lockdown, which has imposed quite severe rules on what we can do and cannot do. You know, dining places and drinking places are now all closed, and we are being told to work from home and not to travel for at least the next month. So we're on to really quite a severe lockdown for the next 4 weeks. I live in the central financial district of London, and I can assure you it's deserted.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, it's kind of like a weird energy, I think, all over the world. You know, some people are still quarantined, like, and having a lockdown like you have over in London. But, you know, here in America, like, people are still a little risque, you know, going outside and doing their shopping and everything. So it's a little bit different. But I think as times continue on, it's going to change, you know. We just have to keep a close eye on it, I think.
Yeah, it's a weird time. It's a really weird year for everybody. And, you know, let's hope, fingers crossed, that 2021 is a happier time.
Mm-hmm, exactly. You said that you mostly worked in government and things like that. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit about policy changes, especially when it comes to the climate crisis that we're currently fighting. I wanted to know, why is it, I could start off with, why is it so important for individuals to understand the issues? And why is it so challenging for us to even have like proper access to certain news outlets? Because, you know, I think with social media, a lot of people just read headlines. And especially with the influx of marketing and fake news and all these different things, I wanted to ask you what individuals can do and search for. And also, why is it so challenging to get policies in place that benefit the overall world, I think?
I try to explain some of these very complex issues in very simple, unscientific language so that people who are looking at these issues for the first time really can understand them quite easily. Then coming on to climate change specifically, you know, it's a very difficult and complex issue to understand. Mm-hmm. You know, this is an issue which affects every part of our life. And because it is so big, we sort of tend to have a feeling that, oh my God, we can't do much about it. It's too big. Therefore, I'm not going to even think about it. And as we think that climate change is a long way away, you know, it's somebody else's problem in a few hundred years' time. But actually, we can see across the world that climate change has already been happening for many decades, problem of the here and now. And it's only when it really affects us that we actually start to think about it. You can have conversations with people who are living in the countryside, and you know, you can say to them, well, you know, have you noticed how your flowers are now flowering a month earlier? And to people who are growing wine, you know, have you noticed how you have to pick your grapes a month earlier, and how you have to change the type of grapes you pick because those ones are not growing anymore in this heat? And to farmers everywhere get climate change, regardless of whether they're in North America or in South Africa, because they're seeing different patterns of rainfall, they're seeing different patterns of heat waves, and this is changing the way in which they grow their food. So most of us, two-thirds of us, Precious, around the world, we live in cities. And so in a way, we're sort of cocooned, we're sort of protected. It doesn't really matter in a way that if it's 10 degrees more or 10 degrees less 1 week, we sit in an air-conditioned office or an air-conditioned home, and generally we can survive through it. But the people who are in the rural areas, particularly, and you know, you've seen California with the burning of the forests there, you know, these people understand the issues better because they're living it on every day, and it's part of their lives.
Right. I feel like it's very difficult to not necessarily believe it, but when you're not directly getting the brunt or the results of said climate change, it's really hard to incorporate it in our day-to-day lives. And then once you kind of do kind of get a grasp of climate change, I think you hit the nail on the head of like seeing it as this incredibly huge picture. You know, it's almost like a rabbit hole. You discover one little thing, whether that be like, you know, the plastic waste or even recycling or whatever it may be, or fast fashion, consumerism, all these things. And it's like this huge uncovering of larger issues at hand. And so you mentioned that farmers and people who work with agriculture are really seeing this firsthand. And how do you think that will play into the food industry as it gets hotter, as you know, there's more flooding and things like that? How do you think that will play into the overall picture of our agricultural systems now?
I think we're already seeing over the last decade quite significant shifts in the way in which we produce our food. And you know, let me firstly say to reassure the people who are listening to this podcast that actually we're doing a tremendous job as humanity in dealing with all of this. Every year the world's population goes up, and every year we manage to feed them. So, you know, let's get this into a sense of perspective, that we are really doing a very, very good job. Also, we have very, very high margins of areas where food production is still low and can grow quite significantly. And food production in Africa is still at a low level in terms of its intensity, and we can improve there tremendously. And let's also say, perversely, that climate change is opening up new areas to agriculture. So we're seeing some of the colder areas in the Northern Hemisphere, which are suddenly becoming possible to plant. And so we will look over the next generations at new areas growing crops that today are not able to do because they're becoming warmer. So let's get this into perspective, okay? This is long-term, generally, a very considerable change in the way in which we live and we do things, but there will be winners and there will be losers. And a lot of those losers will be in the places which are already marginal now. And so if you look at the southern United States, if you look at south of Europe, if you look at the north of Africa, where you already have marginal areas in terms of agriculture and being able to grow crops, these are suffering because these will get warmer, these will get drier. Then you will have places where there will be a greater intensity of rainfall, and therefore it will be difficult to plant crops because they will simply be flooded. Seeing in certain parts of Southeast Asia, and conversely, in other parts of Southeast Asia, we're also seeing greater droughts. And across the world, depending on the season, depending whether there's a Nina or a Nino in the Pacific, we will have hotter, we will have wetter, we will have drier, we will have greater storms to deal with, we will have greater variability. And I think the whole thing about climate change is the unpredictability of what we're going to get. And that makes planning, that makes agricultural planning, particularly for farmers who are in marginal areas, it makes it very, very difficult.
Yeah, exactly. And even on a biological standpoint, even if you said like warmer areas will become drier, but on the northern areas, you know, it's definitely warmer. But because we're not having those harsh winters, you know, usually there's a turnover, like Mother Nature kind of takes place and kills off a lot of the pests and things, let's say in Florida, because Florida is one of those places where you can kind of grow year round, but they need those 3 weeks of mini winter in Florida to kind of kill off a lot of the pests that would take over a lot of the agriculture for the spring. And so it's just very interesting. I think that you're right with that unpredictability. It's really hard to pinpoint, and we can't help but be reactive to whatever is to come unless we take initiative today to kind of slow it down or transition it into a new way.
Well, we are taking a lot of initiatives, you know, and around the world, governments are planning and investing in new ways of producing energy that are less carbon intensive. We're reducing our global greenhouse emissions in many, many countries. Perhaps your country will re-enter into the climate change treaty if Mr. becomes president. And so the countries are aware of this, governments are aware of this, but also populations are aware of the dangers of climate change, and many, many people are taking action. What is very, very encouraging is to see even countries like Korea and Japan and China, who have traditionally been rather indifferent to the argument, they have now taken legal steps to embedding in their legislation targets for zero carbon emissions within the next few decades. And that's really very, very encouraging. We're not going to stop. Somebody asked me this precious couple of weeks ago. I said, well, you know, are we going to get to the end of this century within that sort of magical 2 degrees centigrade figure that is our target as an average increase in temperatures? And the answer is no, we're not. We're going to end up at the end of this century with average global temperatures somewhere between 4 and 6%, 6 degrees centigrade. I guess that's in Fahrenheit. I don't even know. But maybe that's about 10, 12 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than we are now. That's inevitable. But if we act now and continually over the next decades, we can turn that curve back again. Over the next century or so.
That's good. I think that's where the hope lies for sure. I know that you wrote your book, Everything is Connected. I kind of wanted to ask you a little bit more about that because that's how I see the world for sure. I think that's why I fell in love with not only food on just what's on our plate, but kind of how it plays a role in everybody's lives and how it plays a role in our businesses, our health, our pharmaceutical industry, agriculture, our trade. It all kind of is intertwined. And so that's why I'm personally really passionate about that. But I kind of wanted to ask your perspective on your book and how certain policies are kind of all connected and how it can be simplified for the everyday individual.
Well, thanks for asking, Precious. And, you know, I start the book off by saying that, you know, firstly, let's be optimistic. Humanity has done a great job, as I said just a minute ago, feeding almost 8 billion people. But we also forget that, you know, we've done a great job in housing them, in giving them education, and giving, you know, medical care, in providing clean water, providing sanitation services and such like, not everywhere, but, you know, to huge amounts of people. And you know, I'm an old man compared to you, but I can remember that this wasn't the case when I was a young person. You know, people starved in famines and millions of people died in places around the world. Well, that doesn't happen anymore, okay? We really have done a good job. And we live, despite what we see and we read in the news around us, we live in a moment of astonishing peace. You know, our superpowers have all got nuclear weapons, but they don't shoot them at each other anymore. And actually, we live in a moment in world history which is extraordinarily peaceful. So let's take a deep breath and say, wow, actually, we're lucky to be alive now rather than some sort of flea-bitten 16th century place where we always think about the old days as being the good old days. My God, these are the good old days. You know,
that's a good perspective for sure. Yeah,
you know, these are the best times to be alive. All right. So now we've got these challenges. What are these challenges? Well, you know, climate change is the mother of all challenges. We've got plastic pollution. So our oceans and our soils and our rivers are filling up with plastic. We've got the challenge around our forests and how they're being slashed and burned. So all of that, but the pandemics and the illnesses, the sickness, which are coming out of those forests, because those bacteria, those diseases which live in the forests are looking for somewhere else to live. And here we are, lots of human beings, and they jump to us. We're emptying our oceans of fish. I mean, we're illegally and irresponsibly overfishing everywhere. Mm-hmm. And our oceans will be empty of fish. And, you know, you're in the food industry. And you know, the fishing industry is actually responsible for this because it knows perfectly well what is going on. When you look at all these things, and the book looks at these things in a very simple way, it all comes down to activities which are driven by the desire of people to make more and more and more money. Mm-hmm. And so we see that our pension funds, you know, and our big banks, and I name them who they are, invest in factories in the Amazon rainforest. Soon as the Amazon rainforest is slashed in an area, there are our pension funds, there are our big banks, there are our major investors investing in meat processing plants and soybean processing plants with our money. Okay. So, and because it's very profitable, you know, it's short term, it's very, very profitable. And when we see the fishing industry emptying out the oceans and buying roughly one fifth of every fish meal you will eat will be illegally caught fish, so undeclared fish. Mm-hmm. So therefore, beyond all the statistics, difficult to manage and to monitor. And that's because the fishing industry buys that illegal fishing, mainly in the Far East. Why? Because it's much, much cheaper to buy from outside of the quotas than it is to buy within the quota system.
Exactly.
You know, so it's all driven by money, and we see deforestation in Siberia, and even the attempts of deforestation which you have in Canada and the United States, all driven by the desire for small numbers of people to make more and more money. I try to trace these things, but hey, not in a negative way. Let's try and sort these out. As long as we know what's going on, we can sort them out. And so in a way, we have to work out how we move the money to do positive things rather than to do negative mm-hmm. things.
And, exactly.
We do that. We renew renewable energies and organic food and replanting forests, etc. We do that, but we are running out of time to get it right.
Exactly. I think you brought up a really good perspective on how maybe we ought to look at it from a very positive angle, because despite everything, I think we are moving into positive times. And the fact that we're even talking about green initiatives now, I think, is a really big bonus. I think it's just where we're at now. It's like, now that we're in this somewhat of a good place, what can we do to make it better? You mentioned how we're in a time where there's so much food production that no one has mass starvations as much as they did before. But now we're at a place with that sense of consumerism and overproduction, that out of all the food that is produced, 40% of it ends up in a landfill or in the garbage. And so I think figuring out how, like, now that we're in this over, I think we're in an overabundance, over consumeristic kind of society now, where we have one need and then we 10 times it, the amount, and a lot of it goes to waste for easy access or for monetary reasons. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit more related to that, on, because everything is money driven, what can we do, because it seems like the companies are so large, what can we do as individuals or as communities to kind of help change that?
Well, again, let's be optimistic and let's think positively, because we are doing a lot. And the fact that we're sitting here discussing this and that we are where we are, and you're in the United States and I'm in London, and hey, we're talking to each other, shows just how far humanity has come in the last 100 years.
Yeah.
So let's be positive. And if you look at the curve of human progress, it is continually upwards. And all around the world, there's hundreds of thousands of people working on these issues, trying to sort them out and trying to make them better. And so in my book, I suggest that there's several things we can do. Firstly, we can support some of those people. There are associations and there are nonprofit groups and there are NGOs and there are people out there working. Well, if you don't want to get out and help them, I understand. But if you can afford, give them a few bucks, help them along and help them develop their programs. Participate. And the thing I really emphasize is participate in the democratic process. It's so important. The democratic process is one, I think the great Prime Minister of Britain said, Winston Churchill said, democracy is the worst of all systems except for the others. And it is a very difficult system to manage. It's fiddly. You're seeing with your election, it's complicated. Mm-hmm. People can contest it. But in the end, the only way we make progress going forward is this: if we all decide, or a majority of us decide, to go forward together. So that democratic process, wherever you are in the world, is really, really vital. And the good news is that there's a continual curve of the increase of democratic participation across the world, wherever you look. And that means that people are involved, people do vote, people do go out and campaign. And so, take part. And believe in your local community and work with the political process wherever you are to make things better. And third, my third recommendation is, when you do that, ask your candidate or whoever you're working with or whoever you want to support just one really simple question, Precious. And mm-hmm. the question is at the basis of everything you do and I do. And that is my health important to you?
Yeah, I would think so. I believe that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, if the candidate says, the most important thing is the taxes and the business and whatever. Well, then you know that your health is not central to his policy platform. I would not vote for that person because my family health is the number one priority I have. Everything else is secondary. And your health comes through education, it comes through good food, it comes through clean water, it comes through clean air, it comes through clean soils, it comes through exercise and mobility and be able to do that in safety. All these things create a healthy environment in which you can live and which you can be a healthy person. And if that's not central focus to the political process and to the people that are involved in it, then be careful of them.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's a very good mindset to have, because I think sometimes we do put all of these other things first, or we think about them in hindsight, but that really should be our number one priority, the health and the overall safety of our families, you know. And I think definitely over here, it's a little bit more complicated. There's a lot of different strings and whatever you want to address, but I think that really should be on the forefront of our minds.
I can assure you it's the same precious everywhere.
Oh, that's good to hear. So I guess my final up question, what do you hope to accomplish with your book? Who do you hope, I guess, which kind of people do you hope get their hands on it? What do you hope to inspire with your book? And I think that's what I really wanted to know about that. Like, what encouraged you to write it in the first place?
Oh, well, thanks for asking. You know, as I'm getting older, I have a lot of experience, and I've been doing this sort of campaigning for a better world in my quiet little way for the last 30 years, and so I thought now it's actually about time to get some of those experiences down in black and white, so that people can share them, but so that younger people can also learn from some of those experiences. Because if the curve of human development is continually, generally speaking, an upward curve, and well, 2020 maybe is an exception. But if the curve is upward, it's because people like myself and others are working for that to happen. Mm-hmm. So the book is a little bit about how that happened, and therefore, you know, to take some inspiration. As I said, breathe in, relax. It's going to be okay. We're doing all right, but we can also do better. And this is how you do better. And I hope that the book is read by people who are not experts, people who are not from the scientific community. They more or less know all this stuff anyway. I hope it's people who are thinking about their future, about their children's future. I hope it's read by a lot of young people who try to understand some of these complex questions and sort them out in their brain. And I hope it's read by some policymakers. You know, we have politicians and we expect them to be experts, but we forget they're not.
Exactly.
You know, they're not experts. So, you know, it would be really nice if, you know, it changes the mind of a politician, whether that's at a local level or at a higher level, looking at this and thinks, hey, you know, okay, now I understand the issue better. Now I understand what I have to do. And that goes not just for the politician, but that goes for all of us. Now I understand the issue. Now I understand how I can act to help sort it out.
Exactly. Everybody is so incredibly involved. And you mentioned that you want young people and everyday people to pick up your book. What would you recommend for those people to kind of start learning about general issues and issues related to policy change? What do you recommend that they get? How do they get started learning about all these different things? Because they are quite complicated.
Well, I think, you know, give yourself a break and don't beat yourself up. Okay, they are complicated. So, you know, we have lives as well. We got our families, our friends, our boyfriends, our girlfriends. We got to socialize. So, you know, we're not going to spend our whole day doing this and worrying about this. But when you have time, the book I've written and many other books try to give you, if you like, a shortcut through to understanding some of these questions. What I've done in my book is that I've made my book also a reference book. Because it's an ebook, you can click on the references. So if you want to know more about, for example, climate change or about ocean, the situation with our oceans or our forests, you can click on the links within the chapters, and that will take you through to research, to science, to reports, and you can delve deeper and deeper and deeper into the questions. And my book contains some 700 links. So it's also a sort of fantastic encyclopedia to help people go in. But, you know, you can just read it and leave it at that. And you'll have a bit of fun as well. There's some fun stories in there. You know, it's not hard reading. So the other really good publication that I read all the time is National Geographic.
If you want, that's a good one.
Yeah, and want to understand something, you know, around your food systems, around, you know, natural systems, around policies and plastic and climate change. National Geographic is a really excellent publication.
No, thank you for that. I think that would be really helpful for the listeners. I'll be sure to link your ebook in the show notes for everybody to have access to it if they're interested. Something that I do with all of my guests on the show, David, if the listeners didn't have an opportunity to listen to anything that we have said thus far, what 2 cents or last notes would you like to leave them with?
The last notes are what I've said to you already. Let's be optimistic. We all think we're living in really tough times, and we all think that it's going to be a hard day today. But I can assure you, compared to the times we lived in 50 or 100 or 200 years ago, we are living in wonderful, wonderful times. So be joyous, be optimistic, be positive. Remember that you're living in the golden age of humanity and work to make sure that we continue to live this way for as long as possible.
I love that. Thank you so much for being a guest on the show. I really loved having you. I think the listeners got some really great insight into that kind of optimistic spirit moving forward. And I really love that.
It's been a great pleasure to talk to you, Precious. Thank you very much.